Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, Director of Lifelong Learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia.
And I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
This week, we read Luke chapter 4, verses 11 through 30, the story of Jesus' visit to his hometown of Nazareth. We revel in the moments where everything is so good, where the people are enthusiastically with him, before things fall apart terribly. Did the people of Nazareth have unreasonable expectations? Did Jesus kind of pick a fight? And really, why is it that with all the healing he's got planned, none of it is for the people he grew up with? Hometown visits sure are complicated. Thanks for joining. Hello, Bobby. How are you?
Hey, Amy. I'm doing really well. How are you?
I am good. And I am sending you a surprise in the mail.
Yes. What's it going to be?
I was looking for something else on Etsy. I don't even remember what I was looking for. And I managed to come upon these note cards.
Yeah.
And I found a set of them called Cranky Garden Critters. And so they're like, there's one of them in particular that reminds me of you in the very best way.
Oh, it's a worm. I do not like where this is going.
It's a worm wearing a bonnet and frowning so very much. Like, it's a very impassioned frown. But the bonnet is so cute, and it's a worm, like the Bible worm.
Wait, so I'm cute and frowny?
I didn't say you are the worm.
Well, it reminded me of you in the best possible... It reminded you of me in the best possible way. Sounds a lot like this worm.
Like you look like a worm wearing a bonnet?
Yeah.
No,
remember
I didn't
that time
mean
that I wore a fuzzy sweater and you told me I look like a Muppet?
Well, that was true. Well, and you do that thing with your hands.
I like, do.
You're so excited. You play your drums. No, you don't have drums. We should get you a set of drums. No,
yeah.
We shouldn't. Ba-dum-ba. So today we are in Luke chapter 4, verses 14 through 30.
Yes.
Not so much has happened since last time. But I mean, I feel like in terms of the plot, there's not a lot we need to know.
Basically, what has happened is Jesus has grown up. He's been baptized. He's gone through 40 days of temptation, which he has survived and thrived. He's coming back. And this story is the beginning of his ministry.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're at a transition point in Luke's gospel right here.
So I'm just going to jump in. You ready?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Verse 14. Then Jesus, filled with the power of the Spirit, returned to Galilee, and a report about him spread through all the surrounding country. He began to preach in their synagogues and was praised by everyone. So when we open, he has returned to Galilee.
Yeah.
And Galilee is up in the north.
Right.
Where was he?
He was in the wilderness.
Yeah, but that doesn't really tell us. I know. And then I was looking before and I was like, and he was at the Jordan. And the Jordan like runs the whole, you know, the Jordan is long. Do we know where he was?
I mean, I think the point is that he was in the wilderness, like away from civilization. And now he has returned to Galilee to civilization. I have always thought of the wilderness as a reference to sort of down around the Dead Sea, sort of in that dry, arid region.
The reason I ask, I think, is that I keep thinking about your observation about sort of what is happening near the center of power and what is happening sort of on the outskirts. And so it's interesting to sort of trace the path of Jesus from the temple into the wilderness and then up into, like, I don't know, the suburbs. Like,
yeah, it may be more like flyover country. It might be more like Arkansas, you know, to be honest with you, that it's a rich agricultural area. But it's pretty far away from the urban center.
Yeah.
And so it's happening on the periphery for sure.
And the other big thing that we learn in just these two verses is that Jesus's reputation is spreading in a good way.
Yeah.
You know, not just that people are interested in hearing what he has to say, but they're interested enough to talk about him.
Yeah.
And it seems like the reviews are uniformly positive.
I mean, it literally, like, he was praised by everyone. Like, there is, yeah. It's not like some of the folks thought he was all right, you know? It's universal acclaim.
When does that happen? Never.
Never.
Yeah.
Except right here.
Except for here, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, one of the things that is kind of interesting about this story is that Mark also tells a version of this story of Jesus coming to his hometown of Nazareth.
Mm-hmm.
But he tells it in chapter 6, which in Mark is well into Jesus's ministry.
Mm.
And so there's been all of these stories that Mark has told us about healings and teaching and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But in Luke, there's none of that because Luke has moved this story from the middle of Jesus's ministry to the very beginning. And so Luke has to give us a little bit in sort of short order. He's trying to set the stage, I think, for this story. So he's just said real quickly, Jesus has been in Galilee and preaching in the synagogues and everyone loves him.
Yeah. Yeah.
This might be as good a place as any to talk a little bit about synagogues and the sort of the relationship of synagogue to temple and the role of synagogue in Jewish practice.
Yeah, I mean, so synagogues developed in parallel with the temple, right? There's still a temple functioning and people are still going to the temple for pilgrimages and for sacrifice. Synagogues were more like a community center and a house mm-hmm. of study, a place where people could gather regularly to study texts and do teaching and prayer.
Yeah.
And so we're seeing it in this time period, this real rise in the parallel traditions or simultaneous traditions of synagogue life, which eventually become all there is.
The practice in the synagogue becomes reading the Torah and discussing the Torah, and it's really a unique development in Judaism. There were not other traditions that sat around and read and argued about their religious texts. Yeah. There weren't that many traditions that had canonical religious texts.
Yeah.
And so the synagogue really is kind of an interesting innovation in Judaism, and it's what allows Judaism to survive the destruction of its temple, or at least one mm-hmm. of the things
mm-hmm.
When that comes.
All right, should we go on and hear about some of this, the reading of that text?
Let's do it.
Okay, so picking up then in verse 16. When he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. Then he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his mouth. They said, "Is not this Joseph's son?" It's so interesting, you know, that you pointed out that Luke puts this story right here and not farther into his ministry. You know, we just spoke a few weeks ago about the process of sort of differentiation as an adolescent. And now as this sort of introduction to Jesus as an adult in this text, to start in his hometown, that's rough.
No, it is. And it, you know, on the one hand, Luke does give us those two verses that we just read. So to say, like, he didn't actually start in this hometown, but the stuff he did before he got to his hometown is not really worth talking about. But you're right. It does seem like this returning to his home is the thing that really matters in terms of how his ministry gets started. Those other things, they're dispatched in one sentence. But this return to Nazareth is lingered over. And then Jesus's ministry starts after this in a more profound way.
Okay, so it tells us that he read from the scroll of the prophet Isaiah.
Yeah.
The first question that came to my mind when I read this was, did he ask for that scroll or was it just randomly given to him and he chose an e-now? Like, I can't tell whether he had in mind, I want to read from Isaiah. Or whether it was just time to read Isaiah and he pulled out that thing.
Yeah, I've wondered about that. There's two verbs in there that are worth paying attention to, maybe. In verse 17, the synagogue assistant gave him the scroll from the prophet Isaiah.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds to me, at least on the sort of most plain sense reading of it, is that the scroll was handed to him not that he asked for that scroll. So it's like today is that we need to read
Isaiah time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then the next verb is he unrolled the scroll and found the place. Mm-hmm. So Jesus chose in some way this particular passage.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know, but that's kind of the way that I've gotten to it is it happened to be Isaiah day and he chose this passage of all the things he could have read in Isaiah.
And it does to me show Jesus knows these texts really well.
Yeah.
You know, that whatever scroll it is that he's handed, he's like, oh, I know what I want to.
Oh, yeah.
I know what I want to find in here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I love that imagery of he unrolled the scroll and found the place. There's a couple of times in here where the action kind of pauses for Jesus to do something with the scroll. Like he does it here and then he does it again in verse 20. He rolls back up the scroll. And you just have this sense of like rolling a scroll is not fast.
No, it's not fast. I would imagine that most of our Christian listeners have not seen someone roll a scroll in front of the whole congregation. But, you know, in the Jewish community, we read from a scroll every week and it's hard to find the place you need. You can't just look up the page number.
Yeah.
Like you have some sense of how far in the scroll it will be, but you have to be able to judge, like when you look at a section and say it's before or after this, so you know which way to go in the scroll, and even just maneuvering the turning between both your hands. I mean, it is a skill. It is a skill unto itself, rolling the scroll.
And so you've got all the whole group that's gathered there watching him as he's rolling. You don't get a sense of how long it took, but there's a dramatic pause here, and then he reads, and then there's another dramatic pause while he rolls it back up. And so it's just kind of interesting the amount of both the narrative attention, but also the story time that this text devotes to rolling and unrolling of scrolls. And it really sets apart that quote from Isaiah in an interesting kind of way.
So the verse, the section of Isaiah he opens to is Isaiah chapter 61.
Yeah.
The beginning of Isaiah chapter 61. And we just read this a few weeks ago.
That's right.
Towards the end of our Hebrew Bible section, which is so exciting to me because we had this whole conversation about just this verse in that other context.
What do you remember from that conversation that you thought that informs your reading of this text?
Well, I remember two things. One, we had a brief conversation at that time about who is the me in this text.
Yeah.
The Spirit of the Lord is upon me.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about it for long because it seemed pretty clear to both of us that it was Isaiah.
Right. Yeah. The prophet writing Isaiah 61. Yeah.
So we dispatched quickly with that question, but then we started talking about the concept of the Jubilee year that seems to be referenced here. And that idea being, you know, every 50 years, there was sort of this resetting of the systems and any debt that had been accumulated or people who had become indentured servants would be released and we would start over. Everything would sort of revert back to its original ownership or state and we could start over. And to think about this moment in Jesus's ministry as a proclamation that that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to pay attention to what this quotation in Luke does and does not include and what it adds to that original Isaiah 61. So you get the release to the captives, which I think could be understood both in a literal sort of people who are imprisoned are going to be set free.
Yeah.
And could also, maybe should also be read in a spiritual sense.
Yeah.
It says those who are held captive to the power of sin or Satan or however you want to think about that in the world are going to be set free. I don't think those have to be opposite. Like either it means this or it means that.
I would agree with those. You. It can have that whole.
So Jesus, I think, is playing on this kind of both very concrete ideas and also on these spiritual ideas.
Mm-hmm.
He curiously leaves out to heal the brokenhearted from Isaiah 61:1
and 2. He sure does. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he ends right before, you know, in Isaiah 61, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and a day of vindication for our God.
And
Jesus rolls up the scroll right before the vindication, which is, I mean, it's kind of interesting that like Jesus here, at least Luke's telling of the story, Jesus is not interested right here in God's vengeance. Jesus is interested in God's restoration.
Yes.
So he's like cut Isaiah off a little short because Isaiah wanted to talk about both of those things.
Coming from having read this in Isaiah a few weeks ago, what I want to see, when you say this scripture has been fulfilled, the part I want to see fulfilled is this release to the captive, sight to the blind, let the oppressed go free, because that has not happened.
And when you say that has not happened, do you mean sitting here as modern people looking back at what has happened since the first century, that still has not happened? Or do you mean like in the narrative flow of the text, when Jesus says this, that has not happened?
I think both.
Yeah.
I think I mean both, because there, as far as I know, there wasn't some, even if we take this really pretty literally and say, like, this is referring to an actual Jubilee year.
Yeah.
I don't think there was some great, we don't have a record of some great Jubilee year happening where there was like a reset of all the debts and everything started to, you know, go down an easier path.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's the part that I'm awaiting for fulfillment. And the reason that I'm sort of pressing on this point is that I feel like that's how, as we read on, his listeners are also waiting for that part, and that's the part that he's not going to do right now.
So show us some receipts. Yeah.
But up to this point, their response to him, again, uniformly positive.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? Totally positive.
Yeah.
And that the thing that, like, that thing that happens when you're in your hometown, like that, you know, oh, I remember when Jesus, like, ran around the shul with no pants on, you know, like, those, like, sort of memories.
Yeah.
They do identify him with his past, with Joseph.
They
and
do.
Sort of, you know, feel this remarkable, I don't know, I have some sense of, like, could this really be this little boy we knew?
Yeah.
But they do seem to make the connection to the actual person that he is now and take him seriously, which, you know, often you hear people in your hometown won't do that. I don't see that happening here. Like, they are taking him seriously.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. And where you stopped in the reading, I think, was a good choice about where to stop, because the people are, like, everyone in the CEB, everyone was raving about Jesus. So impressed were they by the gracious words flowing from his lips. Like, this is not, you know, like, faint praise or anything like that. This is like an overwhelming sense in this community that Jesus has said something profound. Like, they are all totally on board.
They are all on board.
You're
they
exactly
are
right
with
about
him.
That. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one on your previous point, which I think is related, like, I think what Jesus is saying is this, all of this stuff that you read about in Isaiah 61 is unfolding in my ministry. And so maybe we would not expect to have seen it just yet because Jesus is at the very beginning of his ministry. But the expectation is now it's going to happen. And we see it happening throughout the rest of the Gospel of Luke, but not in the way necessarily that we would expect. And then you get the community saying, we're ready to see this thing happen. And then they're not going to get to see it happen in the way they want to see it happen. And that's going to create tension here in a minute.
Yeah.
The point you're raising about, but what has happened since Jesus? Like, here, if Jesus says, I'm inaugurating the Jubilee, and, like, I mean, hello. Like, if you just look around our world in which we live today, like, we are not in a world in which debts have been canceled and the imprisoned have gone free. Like, I think that's a really important point, and one with which people for whom this text is scripture need to be wrestling with in a in a real way. We'll want to come back to that. For sure.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah.
That's a big one. Yeah. All right. So the people are feeling all good. And then Jesus continues.
Yeah.
In verse 23.
Yeah.
He said to them, doubtless you will quote to me this proverb, doctor, cure yourself. And you will say, do here also in your hometown the things that we have heard you did at Capernaum. And he said, truly, I tell you, no prophet is accepted in the prophet's hometown. But the truth is, there were many widows in Israel in the time of Elijah, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, and there was a severe famine over all the land. Yet Elijah was sent to none of them except to a widow at Zarephath in Sidon. There were also many lepers in Israel in the time of the prophet Elijah, and none of them was cleansed except Naaman the Syrian. So, though the people are happy with him right now, Jesus has some assumptions that they won't be happy with him for long.
Yeah.
What do you make of this doctor cure yourself? What are they talking about?
In my mind, the way to read it in this context is heal your own people. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the people of Nazareth saying, you're our guy. Here you are. and so heal us. Mm-hmm. And Jesus is saying, like, the reason you're excited about me is because you think I'm going to bring this jubilee to you because I'm one of you. Mm-hmm. And they have not actually said that, but maybe they're going to. Like, I mean, that's kind mm-hmm. of human nature in a sense to mm-hmm. say, like, well, if you came out of our community, of course you're going to be most loyal to, most interested in our community. So that's kind of what I read him saying as, I know that once you sort of, this settles in a little bit, you're going to expect that I'm going to have a special relationship with you. Mm-hmm. And Jesus is, he's not interested in that kind of special relationship with them.
Yeah. I mean, I just get this sense of like this, their Jesus's projection on the people of their sense of this like intimate connection and mutual interdependence of all the people in their community. And they... Like when he says that, prophets are never accepted in their hometown, I'm like, but you were accepted in your hometown.
You were accepted, yeah.
You were so accepted that they were like, we are totally team Jesus.
Yeah.
Except that the prophecy he was bringing was not what they thought it was.
Yeah.
I guess. So to have a moment of empathy here for the congregation, for the people in his hometown. It doesn't seem to me unreasonable to think that if he is coming to their town to proclaim that he has been sent to release the captives and recover, sight the blind and all that good stuff, that the reason he's coming to tell them is that he is about to do it for them.
Yeah.
Like it almost seems like a little taunting to say, like, I'm here to do this. Isn't that great news? But not for you.
Yeah. Today it has been fulfilled in your hearing. Really does sound like here, like
I'm about to do it in a way that is really like personally, really personal, like really personally impactful.
Yeah.
Unless, I don't know, then I started wrestling, like, unless Jesus is saying that they aren't the ones who are captives.
Yeah.
You know, that the, I don't think this is what he's saying, but that the Jews are already in some way free.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, like maybe the Jews already understood some of the good news of God, so Jesus didn't need to free them. And so so Jesus needed to free people who didn't know the good news of God. But I don't think that's what he's saying, or at least that's not usually how the Jews are portrayed in the Gospels.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Jesus apparently has done these things in Capernaum. And Capernaum is also a Jewish town.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely not as straightforward as Jews don't need this, non-Jews do.
Yeah.
But it may be something about the people in Nazareth don't need this, but other people outside of Nazareth do. Like there's like what the distinction between Capernaum and Nazareth is not entirely
what are they getting at there?
Clear to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you're right. And I was focused on the mission to the Gentiles because these particular examples that he lists with Elijah and Elisha.
Yeah. Let's talk about those examples quickly. And then maybe we can come back and wrestle with this a little bit. We just read the Elijah story of the widow at Zarephath.
Yeah, we did. Okay, now I didn't look it up in anticipation of this conversation, but let's see what I remember. So there's a famine and God first sends Elijah to an area of the desert where he's got like a raven bringing him food.
Yeah, the Wadi
Cherith. There's a raven. He's got like a little Instacart raven bringing him what he needs. But then eventually that, you know, the water in that area dries up and he can't stay anymore. So he goes to the home of this widow who is like really, she says, I'm about to fix something for me and my son as our last meal, and then we're going to lay down and die.
Yeah.
That's how bad it is.
Yeah.
And Elijah says, well, how about you make me something first?
First, and then you may, like, give me your last morsel of food. It'll be fine.
Right. But then, of course, it you know, then her food is miraculously replenished every day. And then her son nearly dies, but Elijah is able to heal him or maybe resurrect him. We're not sure.
That's right. And then the second person, Naaman was a Syrian, Aramean general, and he had a skin disease. Well, we would say he's a leper. And so he had apparently taken an Israelite young woman captive in a raid, and she came to tell him in the course of their acquaintance about this prophet Elisha, Elijah's disciple. And who could heal him. And so Naaman comes from Syria to Israel, goes to Elisha, says, can you heal me of my leprosy? Elisha says, go and dip in the Jordan 7 times and you'll be clean. And Naaman, kind of interestingly, this is all in 2 Kings 5. Naaman kind of interestingly says, like, I could dip in a river. I could dip in a better river at home, right? Like, the rivers in Syria are better than the Jordan. So, like, why would I even do that? And his servant says to him, look, if he had told you to do something hard, you would have done it and been proud. But mm-hmm. he told you to do something easy, and now you don't want to do it? Like, what's wrong with you? And so Naaman goes and dips in the Jordan, and he's healed. So what holds those two stories together and what the point Jesus seems to be making is those prophets could have gone to lepers in Israel, to widows in Israel. Instead, they went to a widow in Sidon and mm-hmm. a leper who was Syrian, and they performed these miracles outside the population of Israel. And then he's associating that with this thing about Capernaum and Nazareth.
So maybe the issue here is not even so much Israel versus Gentile, but whoever you conceive of as your home team.
Yeah.
You know, there's no home team advantage here.
I think that's a good way to read this story. And so the prophet, the Messiah, the sphere of their activity is broader than you think it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not the case that Elijah and Elisha didn't do anything for Israelites, right? They did lots of things for Israelites. It's just that those two examples that Jesus pulls were for Gentiles. And so I don't think it's exactly like Elijah and Elisha didn't care about Israelites, and so I don't care about people of Nazareth. I think it's that the prophets had a larger sphere of activity, and Jesus has a larger sphere of activity. And the problem is, when you think the home team is the only team, that's when you start to have troubles.
I think that's right, except that Jesus seems to make such a point to not do anything.
That's true.
For the people in Nazareth. Like, he's intentional. Like, why can't he do some healing there and also all these other places? He's already there.
But you said a minute ago, maybe it's not for the people in Nazareth. And one way of understanding what that means is that they're not the people who are poor, imprisoned,
yes.
blind.
Right. Right.
So it's not that Jesus doesn't care about people in Nazareth, but that the people who are in the synagogue with him in Nazareth are actually not physically in the
yes.
position of needing Jubilee.
Yes.
And so he thinks they're going to try to claim something for themselves that really isn't for them, not because they're from Nazareth, but because they have some level
because they actually don't need
privilege.
It.
Yeah, they're not
right. Exactly.
Oppressed.
That they have, it goes to the question of privilege, like who actually needs this right now? Who has the biggest need?
Yeah.
And it might not be you.
And you might guess that's the reading of this text that I like the best.
Otherwise, it feels arbitrary.
It does. Mm-hmm.
Okay, should we read about the cliffhanger?
Let's do it. Cliffhanger. I like that. That was good.
Okay.
That was good.
Verse 28. When they heard this, all in the synagogue were filled with rage. They got up, drove him out of the town, and led him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built, so that they might hurl him off the cliff. But he passed through the midst of them and went on his way. Man, the tides changed really fast in that crowd.
They did.
Yeah. As happens in these stories sometimes, the crowd of people is a powerful and overwhelming force.
Yeah, and it's worth noting in verse 28, everyone in the synagogue was filled with anger. And back in verse 22, everyone was raving about Jesus. So it's not that there are factions in the synagogue. It's that everybody's with them and then everybody's enraged. The whole group is doing both of these things.
Yeah.
I like that the NRSV is like they drove him up there because
they
throw him in a Jeep or whatever, throw him out to the top of the hill.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
What do you think it means that he passed through the crowd?
That's an interesting question. It is an interesting image to have him not like running away from them or around them or whatnot, but it's like he's so unaffected by their threats. Physically and otherwise, that he just, I picture him just sort of like calmly walking through like a veritable Red Sea that has parted for him.
Yeah.
Although it doesn't say it parted. So I don't know. What do you picture there?
Well, I don't know. Like, you know, you'll sometimes read people say this is a supernatural thing that Jesus has done. Like he's put on his invisibility cloak and passed through them.
Uh-huh.
I like your image of like the people sort of parting in a miraculous way and Jesus walking through. I've always read it just as like Jesus, like he was pretty quick and he ran as fast as he could run and he got away from them. I'm not persuaded by the invisibility cloak reading. although some very reputable people, like the Jewish Study Bible says this might have been a, or the Jewish New Testament says this might have been a supernatural event. So anyway, I think he, you know, hiked up his skirts and ran as fast as he could. And he just, got away.
Cool as a cucumber.
Yeah.
So, I mean, okay. Like trying to throw him off a cliff is a little extreme.
Yeah.
But what it demonstrates to me in part is that they really do believe him. Like they believe that he can do this thing, that he can fulfill the part of scripture that they've been waiting for, but he won't do it. I mean, okay, the Jews do not come off looking good here. You should not go throwing people off cliffs. But what good is release in general if it's not available to you?
Yeah.
Is that a selfish question?
And no, it seems totally reasonable. And, you know, I imagine that many of us would have been right there in that crowd if that thing had happened in our hometown where somebody says, hey, it's the year of Jubilee, but Jubilee's not for you. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's what you're trying to do, but I think it's to read this as like not an unreasonable reaction. I would not say from the Jews. I would say from the people of Nazareth.
Yeah.
But I realize those are not entirely distinguishable categories.
Yeah, right, at this point. But you're right. I think it's important for the modern context, like how we sort of generalize those things. I mean, I think it goes back to the point we were talking about earlier. Like, should we picture some kind of modern equivalent where Jesus is preaching at a prison and saying he's only going to release these other captives at this other prison?
Yeah.
Or should we picture Jesus preaching to like upper middle class folks who want legislation in their favor when there are needier, like there are truly downtrodden people who need attention more?
I think that's the right question. And I read it in the second of those ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's how I can make some theological sense of what's happening in this text.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So here we are at the end of this challenging text.
Yeah.
What message would you pull out for listeners today?
You know, in Luke's gospel, this is the very first thing Jesus does. He's been baptized. He's been through this wilderness temptation. He comes to Nazareth, and this is what he says. Let me tell you what my ministry is going to be about. And he says, this is the good news, right? This is what the gospel is. Good news to the poor, release to the captive, recovery of sight to the blind, freedom for the oppressed, the year of Jubilee, debt forgiveness, we might say. And the implication there is if the gospel that you preach is not about those things, you are not preaching the gospel, right? You need to be talking about, proclaiming, living out things that are liberative for the poor, the captive, the blind, the oppressed, the indebted. And if you're not, you're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my mind, that resonates in a really kind of troubling way with a lot of what I think I see among churches in North America in this moment, where the gospel is not about that. And the gospel often is not good news for the poor. And churches often want to think this gospel is about us, where Jesus is maybe saying it's not about you right now because you've already got a pretty good deal, that this gospel is actually for people on the margins and it's going to be uncomfortable for you. And I know how you're going to respond to that and you're going to want to throw me off a cliff. And I think that's actually what some of our communities do. And I mean, I'm right there with them sometimes. Like, I want to throw this gospel off the cliff because it's uncomfortable for me. But I really think that's what this text is calling us to, is to think about in what ways are our faith teachings and our faith practices good news to the poor. And if they're not, we need to figure out a different way of doing what we're doing.
No, I love that. And I love the idea that by starting Jesus's real ministry with this, it is like, this is the checkpoint. Like, this is what you keep going back to.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you see when you read this text?
You know, I heard a podcast a week or so ago. It was an interview with Barack Obama, and he quoted Maya Angelou, and it's like the quote is like burning a hole in my proverbial pocket. Mm. Like, it just applies to everything in my head these days and to this too. So the quote is, you only are free when you realize you belong no place. You belong every place, no place at all. And I think that reading Jesus going back to his hometown first and basically setting his relationship with his hometown on fire.
Mm-hmm.
To me, sets the scene, like sets up a circumstance in which he is free to mm-hmm. do the work that he has to do.
Yeah.
But this feels like a huge differentiation moment where Jesus is going out of his way to say, like, you, Nazareth, are not my special people.
Yeah.
Because I have to be free to do bigger things than that. And so there's a, I don't know, like it's, you know, I often get hung up reading the Gospels about, like, why is this person healed and not that person? And yeah. what do we do with these stories of healing, knowing that there are so many people in the world then and now who don't get that kind of miraculous healing? But thinking about it in those terms helps me, like, zoom out a little bit and say that sometimes things are for the good of God's plan, even though it's not fair to the individual person. Mm-hmm. Like, fairness to each individual person is not the goal here, even though it's how yeah. my tiny human mind is oriented.
Yeah.
So maybe you're right. Like, I think that from a liberation perspective, I love the reading that the reason that Nazareth doesn't get this miraculous healing is that they don't need it.
Yeah.
But I also think that there can be, I think there is truth, a harder truth, but I think there is truth in the idea that, like, the world is not set up about fairness to each individual community
yeah.
and place, and that maybe for the bigger story to take place, Jesus needed to be freed of his connection to his hometown.
Yeah.
And this is how that happened. Like, he went and picked a fight there.
That's deep. I love that. The way you were making me think about is just that moment where everyone loves what Jesus has said, and
yes.
how tempting it would be to, if you were Jesus, to leave the story
there.
And I love what you know, sort of a little bit of an abstracting of what you're saying is Jesus had to get past that moment where he needed mm-hmm. the approval of the hometown crowd. And so the way he did it was he picked a fight with them. He lost their approval. And now he's sort of set free to say what needs to be said, even if it doesn't win him approval. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. I don't know quite what to do with it, but that's where I go. That's the quote that's burning a hole in my pocket.
Yeah. So. I love that.
So next week, we will pick up in Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. Rather a short reading.
It's a good one, though. The story of Jesus calling his first disciples. It's a good
yes.
one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good. Well, I look forward to that.
I'm looking forward to it, too. I will see you then.
All righty. Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced by Bobby Williamson and edited by Joel and Laura Becker. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby. We are grateful to all our supporters for helping us keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois.
Join us again next week when we'll be discussing Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. Until then, keep on digging.